New Balance recently announced the addition of All-American Cooper Flagg to the NB family, joining Cameron Brink and an elite player roster in the brand's mission of growing the game with the next generation of athletes. In part of New Balance's ongoing commitment to supporting athletes off the court, the Boston-based brand plans to work with Cooper on community initiatives in his home state of Maine. To shop the two-way V5, Hesse Low V2, and all New Balance basketball products, visit newbalance.com today.
Shop early, save big, all month long during Black Friday Buildup at Lowe's. Right now, get select pre-lit artificial Christmas trees starting at just $59.98. Don't wait to save. Shop these deals today, in-store or online. Because Lowe's knows deals. Discount taken at time of purchase. While supplies last. Selection varies by location.
Before we get into today's show, we would like to commemorate the life of Ted Wyman, longtime Winnipeg sports reporter who lost his courageous battle with cancer on Saturday morning. It was awful news to receive going into the West Final. I only knew Ted for the last 4 or 5 years of his life, but he was a warm, jovial person who asked great questions, had the respect of everybody in the industry, the Winnipeg Football Club. I want to thank everybody for their outpouring of support. I had players in Winnipeg's locker room after the West Final, unprompted, coming up to me with condolences. There were tears in the press box last night, hugs in the press box last night. And thank you to the CFL, its member clubs, and the Winnipeg Jets. I mean, the outpouring of support from so many people was wonderful. And I know that those closest to Ted really appreciated it. So on behalf of Three Down Nation, we want to offer those condolences as well. Only 58 years old, gone far too soon. If you're someone who cares about the CFL, then at some point you have read Ted's reporting or Ted's stories. And Ted was diagnosed not long before the start of the 2024 season. I know he desperately wanted to get back to covering this league that he was so passionate about. And obviously he didn't get that chance. And that's heartbreaking. So our thoughts go to his family, his friends. Just a really, really lousy day yesterday in that regard. And I just hope that everybody who's going through a rough time with it can get the support they need.
It's definitely sad when you hear the news of somebody who has been around for a long time, Hodge. I'm sure he helped you out learning the ins and outs of not just the Winnipeg Blue Bombers beat, but the CFL in some form or fashion. And the dude was always upbeat. And I just really felt like it was something that hit home for a lot of people, because it's somebody who's close to you or you're used to seeing, I guess I should say. And it makes you think, and I thought Michael Shea said this well after the game, about how you live your life, what's important. And then you might kind of go back to the, not rhythm, he had another word for it, I can't think of it right now, but your routine, and maybe don't live life to its fullest. So I think definitely my thoughts and prayers are with Ted up above and his family that he leaves behind. But it also makes you think that, like, you need to cherish this time. Like, fellas, for example, we're going to Grey Cup this week together. And as much as we think that there's going to be a lot of Grey Cups ahead of us, and I hope that there are, that life is ever changing and that these moments should be soaked up for all that they can and enjoyed. And I think we usually do that, as much as you guys get annoyed with me rambling on about a bunch of different things or kind of getting comfortable and being myself around you guys, like Jean Auge and saying that 100 times last year at Grey Cup. I think it's a reminder that when you're with people that you enjoy being around, you should really take that in your life. So thoughts and prayers with Ted. You know, I can remember countless stories with him talking about not just Canadian football, but being out and about with him. I can remember specifically, I'm pretty sure he was there for this, being out in downtown Toronto with Jeff Hamilton, Doug Brown, and Teddy Wyman was there. And Jeff pulled this little stunt where he got Doug Brown's NFLPA player card and used that to tell one of the people who was at the front of this bar we wanted to get into that Doug was an NFL player and Jeff was his agent. And here's Ted, who I don't want to say is old, but is older than kind of the crew he's hanging with. And he's right along for it. Like, we were going to a kind of a younger, more hipper bar, I guess you would say. Belfast Pub is what I remember. And it didn't bother him at all. He was right in there just having a great time with everybody. And those are kind of some of the memories that I think of when I think of Ted Wyman. I also think of him talking about CFL awards. He was a guy that would have an open and honest conversation, and he would respect your opinion, even though, Hodge, I'm sure you've had these conversations with him too, we were much younger than he was, not just in terms of age, but in terms of covering the league, and not just the Canadian Football League, but professional sports league. So it's long-winded in terms of the feelings that came about for me and the memories that I have with Ted Wyman, but it did really hit home going into the East and West final.
Yeah, I will say, in this industry, there are people who've been around a long time who like to treat newcomers like crap. They're not the majority, but there are people who will try to push young people out of this industry for whatever reason, whether it's because they feel threatened or because they're just that upset with their lives and that crusty. Ted couldn't have been further from the opposite. It didn't matter who you were, how long you'd been covering anything, what your age was. He welcomed everybody with open arms. He would talk with anybody. Zach Kolaris talked about that at the podium yesterday, how Ted was just super easy to talk to. And if you're going to be a good sports reporter, that's a really important skill, is being easy to talk to. Because if people aren't going to talk to you, your career is not going to be very long. So we remember Ted. We appreciate you, Ted. And I'm sure there'll be many toasts to him in Vancouver this upcoming week at Grey Cup. The media contingent there gets smaller every year, it seems, but it will be mighty this year, and we'll all be thinking about Ted, that's for sure.
R.I.P. Ted Wyman. All right, on to the show. Welcome to the Three Down Nation podcast. I'm Justin Dunk, joined by John Hodge and J.C. Abbott. Today, we're discussing the Winnipeg Blue Bombers advancing to a fifth straight Grey Cup.
The Calgary Stampeders being awarded the 2026 Grey Cup.
Maya Turner becoming the first woman to be named a Canada West football all-star.
Luchez Purifoy going off on Instagram about this year's all-CFL selections.
Curtis Rourke having another big day for the Indiana Hoosiers.
And Travis Kelce donning a Blue Bombers jersey on his uber-popular podcast. But first, Chad Kelly suffered a broken ankle late in Toronto's win over the Montreal Alouettes in the East Final, giving way to backup Nick Arbuckle. The veteran journeyman got it done, sealing a 30-28 win for the Boatmen, and got the nod as the Grey Cup starter from head coach Ryan Dinwiddie. What were your thoughts on the East Final and Toronto's chances in the CFL title game without their franchise passer?
First, on the East Final, I thought when Chad Kelly went down that the Alouettes were going to come back and win this football game. And yes, Arbuckle did his part, but the Argonauts defense came up large in that game, especially on that two-point convert. So I think that we got to remember that going into this Grey Cup against Winnipeg, that this Argos defense, and specifically the front, are elite, and I think the guys in the back end probably don't get enough credit, although there's a big test looming against a red-hot Zach Kolaris and Kenny Lawler, Nick Dembski, Brady Oliveira, and that offensive line, that played so well for Winnipeg. But what a story for Nick Arbuckle, who was a free agent afterthought. He did not sign with the Argonauts until May. That means literally everybody in the CFL, including Toronto, were okay with their quarterbacks coming out of the busiest part of free agency, going through March, going through April, and then the Argos are like, Chad Kelly's going to be out for these 9 games. He's probably not going to appeal them. We should probably go get a veteran to help Cameron Dukes, the young guy, get through these first games of the season, the first nine games of the season, I should say. And then here he is in the East Final, bringing it home for the Argonauts, and has a chance to start in the Grey Cup, similar kind of to what Ryan Dinwiddie went through in 2007 when the quarterback in front of him, Kevin Glenn, got hurt in an East Final and Dinwiddie was thrust in as a starter. Now, Arbuckle's not making his first career start in the Grey Cup like Dinwiddie did. However, it is an opportunity for Arbuckle to reboot his career when it was on life support for a little while there, especially in the spring.
Yeah, let's talk about the injury. The video of it is wild. Chad Kelly seems to realize something's wrong with his right leg. He stands up when putting weight on his right leg, and this is going to be graphic, I apologize. His leg simply hinges at 90 degrees where it's not supposed to, and he lays down and then physically holds his leg together. I can't think of anything, maybe I'm just squeamish, but I can't think of anything less appealing than the thought of having to physically hold two pieces of my leg together. That was awful. And wildly, the thing that also really stood out to me was Dejon Allen, CFL reigning most outstanding offensive lineman, their starting right tackle. Seeing the injury, this was caught on TSN's broadcast, seeing the injury, and he fell to the ground screaming in anguish and anger, frustration, like, oh my God, our franchise guy's leg is toast, right? Like obviously from that point on, it was clear Chad Kelly was not going to be playing in the Grey Cup. And love him or hate him, obviously, I know a lot of people do not hold Chad Kelly in high esteem. Personally, I would echo what Mike O'Shea said after Winnipeg's game when I asked him about the injury, and we've got those quotes up at 3donation.com, saying, you know, at the end of the day, my thoughts would be with any player who got injured, because we're talking about a human being. And Chad Kelly, for all his mistakes, self-admitted mistakes that he made last year with the Toronto Argonauts, is still a human being, right? And he's going to be in a heck of a lot of pain over the next 6 to 9 months as he rehabilitates from surgery. Should also be said, though, let's call a spade, Chad Kelly was terrible through the first 29 minutes of this football game. He was so good in the East semifinal, essentially perfect against Ottawa. He comes out in this one, and his first play through the air, he's running around like a maniac, seems to point Mekhi Polk upfield, and then he just launches it into the middle of nowhere, and it gets picked off. And immediately it was like, wow, this is just 2023 all over again. This is the Chad Kelly potpourri interception parade. And he ended up getting better, right? He hit DeMonte Coxey for a sensational touchdown to end the first half. That was a risky call by the Toronto Argonauts that paid off. But in terms of Nick Arbuckle, I think you got to give him some credit, right? He had the opportunity to put the game away. The run game got stuffed, right? Second down comes up and we were all debating it. Everybody was watching it together in the press box. Do you run the ball here? I think it was second and eight. If you run the ball, you're probably not getting a first down, but the clock keeps moving to kill that clock to go to the Grey Cup. Instead, Nick Arbuckle drops back, slings it over the middle of the field, a high-risk throw. Fantastic ball, first down, and then to really kill the clock, he hit the outbreaking route. I think it was David Unger in the middle of the field. I think it was Mekhi Polk towards the sideline. I can't remember, but regardless, it was a gutsy, gritty performance late in the game by Nick Arbuckle. And if you're an Argonauts fan, should you feel as good going into the Grey Cup with Arbuckle as you would with Kelly? No, let's be honest. But I think that late game performance from Nick Arbuckle showed he's not going to be a pushover. That was a heck of a performance late in the game against a very talented defense. There's no reason why Nick Arbuckle can't lead the Boltmen to a win next week.
Yeah, it was very impressive from Arbuckle coming off the bench because, as you both alluded to, as soon as Chad Kelly went down, there was a sense that, okay, this game's over and the Alouettes are going to be able to come back. And they didn't. The team rallied around Arbuckle. They were motivated. Arbuckle talked after the game of feeling like he wanted to stick it to the Montreal crowd because he believed that they didn't react properly to Chad Kelly's injury, jeering him and laughing and chanting. Now, there have been multiple reports from people in the stadium that have disputed those claims by Arbuckle and said he completely misinterpreted what was happening. But regardless, it seems like him and his teammates felt that way as they all came out onto the field in support of Chad Kelly, and they found the motivation they needed to make the handful of plays to pull this game out. It changes the entire structure of their strategy for the Grey Cup, in my opinion, because Nick Arbuckle, for all his many strengths, is not Chad Kelly in terms of his big playability. But we do need to remember they didn't win this game because of anything that Chad Kelly did, with the exception of two plays to DeMonte Coxey at the end of the first half. This was about forcing six turnovers. This was about scoring on special teams. And we saw early in the season when Chad Kelly was suspended, when they had Cameron Dukes and Arbuckle at quarterback, the Argos were able to win games because of those two things. Forcing turnovers, scoring on defense, and scoring on special teams. If they can do that again against Winnipeg, they have a shot regardless of how Arbuckle plays, and they are experienced in doing those things and being in that type of situation.
Arguably, the most impressive thing is the fact that the Argos, if I can speak today, were able to refocus and finish the game, to Hodge's point. Like, that was graphic. It was disgusting. It was something that you don't want to see. It was a leg or an ankle that was facing a way that's not supposed to happen. And it makes me think of when I was at the University of Guelph, 2009, my final season there, Cam Thorne, an offensive lineman who played in the CFL for a little while, great dude, went down in kind of a similar way. And literally, it was like the parting of the Red Sea. Everybody saw that his leg was pointing the wrong way and just broke away. And the ambulance came, carted him off. He had to have, you know, plates and screws put in and all that stuff. And the guy still went on to play in the CFL. Like, what a tough SOB. But when those things happen in a game, it is difficult to bring the energy back up, to get your adrenaline flowing again, to go back and hit people and be physical, because you've just seen what is possible in the risks of playing football right in front of your eyes. And I thought that was the thing that stuck out most to me about the Argos, is that in the biggest moment of the game, biggest moments, I should say, after Chad Kelly went down, this team did not flinch, and it seemed like they were able to flick that switch right back on, finish it off, and get to the Grey Cup. Really impressive mindset stuff from the Argos.
Let's talk about the Alouettes a little bit, which is to say, what are you doing? Hold on to the ball. Like, the Alouettes were the better team for large stretches of this game, and they lost five turnovers. Two picks from Cody Fajardo. One was not even remotely his fault, as Walter Fletcher kind of bobbled it and then was like, here you go, and just kind of shoved it into the awaiting arms of a defender. It was a comedy of errors for the Alouettes through the first half. And as much as after Chad Kelly's first pick, I was going, wow, this is a repeat of 2023. When I saw the Alouettes repeatedly turf the football, I thought, okay, no, this is the opposite of 2023. This is turnover city going the opposite way. And I feel bad for Toronto's defense, because at the end of the day, they probably deserve to win this game. Yes, the Alouettes put up 470 yards, but the Argonauts forced those turnovers. They got home for four sacks against a good Montreal offensive line. And pardon me, I got like 4 hours of sleep last night. The Alouettes got home for a sack. They forced two turnovers of their own, and they held the Argonauts to 339 yards of offense. All great numbers, especially considering Chad Kelly played most of that game. The Alouettes defense deserved to win this one. Offensively, I just talked about the numbers they put up, 470 yards of that offense. But, I mean, man, you got to hold on to the ball. Like, this team had the makings of a Grey Cup team. They were the top team for so much of the regular season. Yes, they faltered late, losing four of their last seven with a tie in there. But, I mean, they were super competitive with Winnipeg in Week 21, losing 28-27 at home. They were super competitive in this game. They just couldn't get it done. And that's really too bad for the fans in the Belle Province. And the other loser here, I should say this as well, going into this game, and I don't want to sound like I'm spreading a conspiracy theory because I'm not suggesting anything nefarious in any way. All I'm saying is looking at this matchup from the East Final and the West Final, if you're the CFL, there's two very obvious teams you'd prefer to have in the Grey Cup. Again, I'm not suggesting they're changing the officiating or anything like that. All I'm saying is you want Montreal in it because Montreal is going to bring the French language audience that has been tremendous on television all year. And you want the Saskatchewan Rough Riders because, first of all, you've got a ton of displaced Saskatchewanians living in BC. They've all got budget to travel. Winnipeg has traveled to four straight Grey Cups. Those fans at some point are just out of money. They can't keep going to Grey Cups. And I think the rest of the fans across the country are sick and tired of Winnipeg being in the game. So if you're a CFL employee, surely you're hoping, come on, Montreal Sask, let's go. They've got candles and pictures of, you know, you got a picture of Craig Reynolds on this side and a picture of, I don't know, like Pierre-Carl Péladeau on this side, and you're channeling Anthony Calvillo. And
bro, are you having a dream or Ron still
Lancaster.
Sleeping?
Didn't happen. But all I'm saying is the Alouettes had every opportunity to win this game. They didn't, and the TV rating, as we've been reporting all about this year, is going to suffer next week as a result.
Where was Marc-Antoine Dacroix's rant after the game?
It's a good question. I mean, he ranted this week about them not being the favorite, and it's like, well,
A bunch of BS.
Well, have you seen? Well, actually, and the ironic thing is they were the favorite. It was -2.5. Well, not heavy. It was -2.5. When you're at home, like generally you get 3 points. So I suppose the odds makers were saying, okay, these are two evenly matched teams. If it was a neutral site game, it'd be a pick 'em. But yeah, that was odd. I picked Toronto to win. I think a lot of people picked Toronto to win, and Toronto won despite losing their quarterback to a busted ankle. So I don't know. I like Marc-Antoine Dacroix's rants typically. This one I kind of went, eh, interesting.
Well, you and me, Hodge, we both sat on our pick show and we picked Toronto, but we said the path to victory for the Alouettes was that they had to sort of revive that old formula of strong defense, get a few takeaways, and hold on to the football. And they were basically able to do everything except hold on to the football, right? And that cost them this game because they were the better team for most of it, but they just had those mistakes. And you want to talk about early on Chad Kelly's first interception, that being an indication of, okay, here we go again. Well, we haven't mentioned the thing that happened at the end of that play, which was Mekhi Polk coming out of nowhere, hustling back and punching the ball out of Najee Murray's hands and giving the ball right back to Toronto. Right from that moment on, you could tell that there was something going on with the Argonauts in terms of how focused they were on generating turnovers and getting the ball back and getting their hands on that pigskin. And Montreal just didn't have an answer for a way to prevent those turnovers. It was mistakes on offense. It was mistakes on defense when you can't convert on an interception like that. And it was mistakes on special teams, letting Janarian Grant pick up a bouncing ball and go 71 yards to the house. So the Alouettes got everything that was coming to them because they could not execute the game plan that everybody laid out for them as a path to victory. And ultimately, even with everything that Toronto went through in terms of the Kelly injury, it wasn't enough to get the Alouettes back on top.
Can we talk about Jason Moss's invitation?
What was the invitation?
JC knows.
I know exactly what you're referring to.
Yes. Oh, I got what you're saying. Well, why don't you dive into it?
Jason Moss was seemed to be a little upset with Herb Zerkowski following the game when he brought up the team's record during the final 6 or 7 games of the season. I believe you mentioned it already, Hodge, but was it 2-4-1 over that stretch once they had clenched up? And the head coach took issue with that assessment, and even invited Mr. Zerkowski, who is the longtime Montreal Gazette beat reporter, to come and watch the film with him so he could show him that this wasn't a 2-4-1 football team and they didn't have that mentality. I would say that the results beg to differ. but
you are what the record says you are, right? Are we going back to this process versus results discussion again? Like, I don't understand it. Hang on to the football and win, and you get the praise. When you lose, people are going to ask you sometimes difficult, but mostly fair questions. Mm-hmm. I just don't get this. Like, Jason Moss has been, I will say, good to me for the most part. I think actually throughout my entire career when I've asked him difficult questions. But I just find it interesting when, especially after a loss, some people's potential true character is revealed like this. It's clear that emotions are running high. Your season has just ended. I get all that. But it does pull back the curtain just a little bit on who some of these guys really are.
I will say, just so that we have this correct, so the Alouettes were, they were 10-1 as of week 12. They went on a bye, and when they came back from that bye, after that they went 2-4-1, as JC laid out. But the first four games of that, they had not yet clinched the East. So while still trying to clinch the East, they got walloped by BC at home. They went on the road to Calgary and tied, tying in Calgary in 2019. Very impressive. In 2024, ouch. Week 16, they beat Ottawa in Ottawa, and then they go to Toronto, lose a close one. On week 18, I believe it was, they were on bye, they clinched first, and then when they came back from that bye, they beat Ottawa, got crushed in BC, a game they looked completely out of sorts, and then played Winnipeg really close. So that's their last seven games. Two wins, four losses, one tie. Four of those games played before they clinched. So those are the facts. I thought it was a perfectly fair question. Though, I will say, if a CFL coach offered me to go watch film, that sounds awesome. I want to learn more about football. I was talking to Luke Mullender in the press box yesterday about Cover 3 Cut, because Zach Collaros keeps talking about Cover 3 Cut. And I'm like, can you please break this down? He got out the pen. He got out the napkin. So I got smarter. So Jason Moss.
Hodge, bro, we've gone over Cover 3 Cut before, have we not?
I don't think so. And it turns out, okay, this coverage makes perfect sense. It's not rocket science. But I just wanted to be clear on it because I had a vague idea of what it was, and now I got it.
Yeah, is it an open invitation, good, Mr. Moss? Because the Three Down Boys will pack up our bags. We'll head to Montreal this offseason. Let's do a pod right from the Montreal film room. Let's break down the Alouettes game.
And he can explain why his team's losses were actually wins.
New Balance recently announced the addition of All-American Cooper Flagg to the NB family, joining Cameron Brink and an elite player roster in the brand's mission of growing the game with the next generation of athletes. In part of New Balance's ongoing commitment to supporting athletes off the court, the Boston-based brand plans to work with Cooper on community initiatives in his home state of Maine. To shop the two-way V5, Hessilo V2, and all new Balance basketball products, visit newbalance.com today. Oh, oh, oh,
O'Reilly! You've got questions? O'Reilly Auto Parts has answers. Need a pro you can trust? We've got that too. No matter what you need, our professional parts people have the training and expertise to help you do things right. Deep automotive knowledge. Just one part that makes O'Reilly stand apart. The professional parts people. Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
Auto Parts.
The Winnipeg Blue Bombers beat Saskatchewan in the West Final 38-22 as Zach Collaros threw for 301 yards, 19 of 26, and four touchdowns, perfect passer rating. Three of those strikes went to Kenny Lawler, four catches for 177 and three tugs for Lawler. What a day. The Riders struggled against Winnipeg's tough defense, unsuccessfully going for it on third and three, deep in their own zone on the 24-yard line with just over 12 minutes to go in the fourth quarter. The win pushed the Bombers to their fifth straight CFL title game. What were your thoughts on the West Final, and how pumped are you for the Grey Cup?
This game shocked me. If there was one thing I was sure about, it's that this game was going to be close. Turns out, what the hell do I know? Winnipeg had three big special teams mistakes in this one. They allowed a blocked punt. Great play by Caleb Saunders. He, by the way, got drug tested after the game, and that's probably because at 290 pounds, he's so good at blocking punts. They had the lucky Whitehead fumble late in the game, and they had the Adam Korsak, which I don't believe was a called fake punt. I think he just saw that no one was setting the edge and took it and ran. So three big mistakes on special teams. Other than that, this performance was almost beyond reproach for Winnipeg. And we talked about it on our picks piece this week, JC. We talked about it on the pregame show on CKRM Dunk. Winnipeg has generally not played very well in West Finals. Mm-hmm. Like, they've won a bunch in a row. Full credit to them. But, you know, they played a hobbling Nathan Rourke in 2022. They played a hobbling Vernon Adams Jr. in 2023 with Keon Hatcher and TJ Lee going down early. They gave away a million turnovers in 2021. This team finally showed up in the West Final and fully flexed. Like, this was arguably their best performance of the year against a top defensive line. The pass rush was a virtual non-factor. Zach Collaros took a hit from Miles Brown on his first touchdown pass to Kenny Lawler. In the second half, he got pulled down to the ground when he held onto the ball after play action, kind of waiting for Nick Dembski on a crossing route. Other than that, I'm not sure he got hit. He did not get sacked. I think he got hit twice. Rushing the ball, Brady Oliveira said he took it personally. He said early in the week he saw an article about how he couldn't run the ball against Saskatchewan. He took a screenshot, looked at it every day. He said our offensive line took it personally. 119 yards at a touchdown. Tremendous performance from him. And then defensively, like Trevor Harris, yeah, he got to 283 yards, full credit. He needed 44 pass attempts to get there. By the way, Kean Schaefer-Baker, 17 targets. I feel like that has to be a playoff record. I'll verify with the league. But every throw, it felt like, Trevor Harris, aside from one breakdown in coverage, which came after an injury substitution with Nick Taylor coming in at safety, every pass, it seemed, was contested. Like Evan Holm, four knockdowns. Mm-hmm. Unbelievable. And by the way, he's a pending free agent. So his agent was watching the game going, aha, we're making some money today. But Terrell Bonds, I mean, a knockdown. Tyrell Ford, knockdown. Willie Jefferson, two knockdowns at the line of scrimmage. Like every single time Saskatchewan had something. He had a whale of a game. Reddick Ramdy, I think, is one of the most underrated players in the league. I'll continue to write that. And he's a nice guy as well. But regardless, offensively and defensively, this was an outstanding performance. Winnipeg finally put together an entire game. And I don't feel like, by the way, Saskatchewan played poorly. That's the other thing. It wasn't like, you know, offensively, Trevor Harris was off the mark and making terrible reads. It wasn't like AJ Ouellette was getting stuffed left, right, and center. He had a couple nice runs. Defensively, they had a couple.
He was getting stuffed pretty good, man. Too many first down run calls.
He still averaged 5.1 yards per carry, which is legit. Now, there was a 26-yarder, in fairness, that bumped that total up. But regardless, the point I'm trying to make is this wasn't a case of Saskatchewan coming out flat and Winnipeg looking good by comparison. I thought the Riders...
It was 14-0 off the bang. The Riders did not have enough energy. To start, for sure.
I think that's fair, but on the whole... This wasn't a game where I felt like the opponent, because I've seen this at Princess Auto Stadium before, with the crowd, with the energy, with the everything. I've seen teams come in, make one mistake, and just roll over and show their belly, like my dog does when she's asking for a belly rub. That's not what the Riders did in this game. I think they deserve credit for that, but I also think the Bombers deserve credit for just putting one on them. It was an unbelievable performance.
What impressed me most about this game was... not the fact that the Winnipeg defense was tremendous in the secondary, because we knew that already. We knew that they had the best secondary in the league, arguably, with guys like Terrell Ford and Dietrich Nichols and Evan Holm making those sorts of plays. It wasn't that they were able to salt away the game with Brady Oliveira grinding out the football, because we knew that they were capable of that. It's that we got to see the explosive passing offense with Zach Collaros and Kenny Lawler that has been missing for large chunks of this season. Yes, there have been a couple of games where they've gone off and put up big numbers, but it has not been the same passing attack for the Bombers this year that we've become accustomed to seeing over this run of dominance. And to have it.
Well, Kenny Lawler was out for a while and Dalton Schoen missed the majority of the season. So you got some rookies in there. I think we need the context there.
Hey, that is important context, but Kenny Lawler's been back for half the year now. And even in that time, he hasn't put up the numbers that we're used to seeing. And need I remind you that also Kenny Lawler missed a large chunk of last season as well, but still put up much better numbers in that year or was much more consistent over that stretch. It's just been a little bit off. Zach Collaris' numbers haven't been as good. He's had a bunch of middling performances. And on the rare occasion when it's all come together, we've seen the flash. To have it happen in a playoff game when they needed it, to make a statement like that, I think it changes the dynamics of what we thought this version of the Blue Bombers team is, and it proves that they can win in a variety of different ways when it comes down to it. If you have to deal with Kenny Lawler, and you've got to deal with Brady Oliveira, and you've got to worry about their defense completely shutting you out, there is no easy way out here for the Toronto Argonauts next week in the Grey Cup. If they can keep this sort of momentum going offensively, I think they have the potential to put up a whole lot of points against what is a very good Toronto defense. It's just tough to contain a guy like Lawler. He is the ultimate mismatch in the CFL.
The offensive line for the Winnipeg Blue Bombers absolutely dominated this game. On the other side, the Riders had way too many mental errors, way too many drops, and missed some of their opportunities. You're talking about Keyshawn Johnson in the back of the end zone not coming down with that football. You have to catch that in the playoff game. I don't care if it's a little bit out of your reach or if you have to extend a little bit more. Nelson Lacombe leaving Nick Dembski wide open on a simple hitch route in the end zone can't happen. Amari Henderson or Roland Milligan or Nelson Lacombe, whoever it was, leaving Kenny Lawler wide open down the left sideline on a goal ball cannot happen. That's arguably, no, not even arguably, the one dude you got to cover. I know Nick Dembski's really good. He's a 1,000-yard guy too, but you have to cover that dude. That's inexcusable. I know Corey Mace wants to put this on his shoulders. He said it was, quote, a shitty game plan, and he's going to take the brunt of it. And overall, when you zoom out, the 2024 season was a successful one for the Riders. But to be honest, I think you guys are being too kind here. This was not anywhere close to even a good performance for Saskatchewan. Considering the swagger that they came into the game with, I thought it would be a close game, like Hodge said. And I did actually think there was a realistic chance for the Riders to win. But there were a couple quotes that stuck out to me during the week. And the one in particular was from Brady Oliveira, who I think kind of let it slip. But he said there were some holes that the Bombers believed they could attack in the Riders' defense. And oh boy, did they ever. And Hodge, I won't use the same terminology you used offline, but Zach Collaris was praising this Saskatchewan defense over and over for their speed and the physicality and the turnovers. When he does that, I think our red flag should go up next time, because he knew, he had this sense of confidence that they were going to be able to go into this football game and take advantage of some opportunities. And oh boy, did they ever ball out. But that Winnipeg offensive line was absolutely dominant. If they play like that in the Grey Cup, I don't think it's going to be close.
Yeah, a quote that stood out to me from Stanley Bryant. And for context, Stanley Bryant, I mean, obviously future first ballot Hall of Famer. He was very emotional after the Grey Cup loss in Hamilton. I think he figured that might be his last game. Big Stan, as he's affectionately known, is usually very cordial, very jovial, sits in his locker, always happy to talk. Last year, the media, like the locker room at Tim Hortons Field opened to the media. And the first thing that happened, it was like a flash. It was like, pfft. It was like, what the heck was that? And it was Stanley Bryant already in his street clothes, just ripping out. Like, it was clear he did not want to talk to anybody. It didn't end up, of course, being his last game. He came back. So I asked him, you know, how you feeling going into the Grey Cup? And this was the quote. He said, quote, "We knew what to expect. We'd seen a lot of them this season," referring to Saskatchewan. We knew what they were going to do, so we just had to stick to our guys, win our one-on-ones, move bodies and open holes for Brady and protect Zach. Once we get both of them going, I think we're unstoppable. So we got to be ready for next week and get it going. And the word unstoppable, I don't think is inappropriate here. I mean, Zach Collaros, again, we talked about it. And yes, it's true that Kenny Lawler is out for part of the season. Dalton Schoen missed most of the season. But we hold Zach Collaros to a high standard because he is a guy who, by the way, will be starting his sixth Grey Cup game next week. Unbelievable. But he's a two-time MOP. He's going to be in the Hall of Fame, right? He shouldn't be held to the same standard as, you know, a guy who's just starting out. He had a negative touchdown interception ratio for most of the year. Finished in the positive, buoyed by a 6-touchdown game against Edmonton. But he looked as good as I've ever seen him against the Riders in this one. His first throw was a little bit kind of an awkward trajectory to Nick Dembski. He threw another one that kind of sailed. Carrick Wheatfall, 6'3", came up, brought it down. Other than that, he was close to perfect. And that's the type of playoff performance we haven't really seen from Zach. The only game that he's looked really good as a Blue Bomber in the playoffs, in my opinion, was the 2019 West Final when he went into Saskatchewan against a very talented Riders team and beat him. The West Semi before that, Chris Streveler and Andrew Harris ran all over the Calgary Stampeders. And that Grey Cup, Andrew Harris ran all over the Hamilton Tiger Cats. Zach did not have to do much in those two games. And since then, he's been mediocre in the playoffs. That was a signature performance for Zach Collaros. And dare I say, if he has another one next week, they may as well already start building the statue to him. They're redoing, currently in Winnipeg, they're redoing Portage in Maine, which is the most famous intersection in Winnipeg. I think they should just put a big old Zach statue in the middle. If he throws for 4 tugs next week, how could you not, right? How could you not?
I do think it's worth diving into the Saskatchewan Roughriders a little bit more. And you touched on some of their failings, Dunk, but this season is an interesting one for me because they've come so far from where they were. But ultimately, this was still a 9-8-1 football team, just above 500. And that's impressive progress for Corey Mace in his first year. But this moment seemed too big for them, right? And I thought some of the decisions that they made, both in terms of scheme that got exploited, but also in terms of game management, like going for it on 3rd-and-3 that early from deep in your own end, like he did with 12 minutes left, I thought was one of the most egregious coaching mistakes that I've seen in a playoff game. It reeked of desperation. And I know that Corey Mace was trying to get something going for his team, but this is the CFL, right? The final 3 minutes can be an entirely different game. They had the opportunity to still be in this football game if you play that field position battle a little bit more smartly. At that time, they were not completely out of reach, down 2 scores with 12 minutes left. That's not a terrible position to be in 3-down football. But instead, he panicked. He went for it too early. And Winnipeg was able to immediately score. And now it becomes 3 scores, and the game is getting out of hand. I thought that was a pretty clear error from the coaching staff, and I think it just speaks to the fact that, yes, for all the distance that they've come, this is still a young team. This is still a team that is learning how to win in these scenarios, and hopefully these are lessons that they can apply learning for going forward.
I think it was clear, Corey Mace explained it, that he was trying to create some momentum for his team, but the inconsistency, as pointed out by our contributor Joel Gasson, in going for it on 3rd-and-3 on your own 24-yard line versus kicking a field goal on 3rd-and-2 in plus territory, I believe that was in the first half, is what I think has Rider Nation scratching their heads at that decision. But Mace, I don't know if you guys saw this, doubled down on the decision postgame, said he would probably do it again. Mm-hmm. Now, I understand that he has a lot of confidence in Trevor Harris, but that decision right there can effectively end the game, which is what it did, right?
Yeah.
Tyrell Ford knocked the ball down that was intended for Keyshawn Johnson. Then 2 plays later, Brady Oliveira's in the end zone. Ball game was essentially over. If you punt, And I'm all for being aggressive with an offensive background. To your point, JC, you're still in the football game. And here's another point too. And I'm not necessarily for playing it safe and conservative, but if Corey Mace punts there and his team goes on to lose, let's say, there's not, as you called it, JC, an egregious decision that Rider Nation can point at and question and debate and talk about throughout the offseason. Now, I understand being aggressive. I'm just saying from an optic standpoint, if you don't go for it there and you punt the football, nobody's going to get up in arms. Mm-hmm. I get that you're trying to put your foot on the gas, but I'm just pointing that decision out that if you punt the football there, I think it's a much different feel around this game, and you're not pointing to this one thing that's obvious to everybody, no matter how much football they've watched, that was standing out from the game. I'm not saying he should or shouldn't have done it, because I understand the situation he was in. I appreciate Corey Mace's reasoning. And I would say for the most part with the media, he's answered direct questions, especially from yours truly, with respect. And I thought that he did that again after the game with this decision. But he's also smart enough to know that when he makes a decision like that, there could be the ramifications on the other side if you don't get it. So what I don't understand is like us in the media talking about Corey Mace being a first-year head coach and saying, well, the moment's too big for him. I'm sure that in his head, after that second down happened, he had been processing why he was going to go for it on third and three in that position. So let's not just say, oh, well, he's a rookie head coach. The moment was too big for him. He had his reasoning as well. I think that is a fair side of this debate, I guess we'll call it, for this moment that a lot of Rider fans are going to look at for at least the offseason.
Yeah, I don't mean necessarily that the moment was too big for Mace personally. I think he struggled with that particular decision and made ultimately the wrong call. I meant more that the game itself for the Riders team as a whole, it seemed like the moment was too big for them, that they couldn't rise to the occasion with some of the mistakes that you mentioned earlier, letting Lawler get free down the sideline. It just seemed like in every facet, the things that they had done so well or consistently in the last few weeks when the chips were down and it really mattered, they just couldn't quite execute. They were just a step behind, a step slow. It seemed like they got overwhelmed by the massiveness of that moment. And that's something that they'll have to learn from because, again, they haven't been here in a few years. This team has not been to the playoffs in two seasons. To be in a West final was seen as a victory for this team. It won't be seen as a victory next year, right? They'll have to take the next step, and I believe that they will because there's a lot of talented pieces here. And I do believe in Mace as a coach long term. This was just sort of a lesson that had to happen for this entire group.
You know, guys, we've talked about the Riders being a young team, but how about the Bombers in that West final? They looked fast, spry, agile, mobile. Like this team clearly took that week of rest and used it to the best of their ability, because people want to say that they're aging and they're getting to the end of the dynasty. And it was maybe teetering there in Montreal with what went down, the Joseph Zima punt, the gust of wind, Sergio Castillo field goal gets them the home game in the West final. But this team looked rejuvenated and did not look old to me. That team was flying around on all facets of the game.
I want to take us back to 2016. So hop in the DeLorean with me, will you? This was Mike O'Shea's first playoff game as a head coach in BC, playing against the Lions. They build a lead. Long story short, the Lions come back, go up 32-31 with 1 minute left. Matt Nichols gets the ball, drives the field. Suddenly, Winnipeg finds themselves third and four. They are at the 54-yard line of BC. There's 30 seconds left. If they convert the third down, they probably get into field goal range for Justin Medlock, who is having an incredible season. Instead, despite it being out of his range, Mike O'Shea sends Justin Medlock out for a 61.5-yard field goal attempt. He kicked it with a tee, which he never usually does, And kickers will tell you that when you kick in a dome, the air is a little more dead, so your distance is actually hindered a little bit. And lo and behold, Justin Medlock missed the kick. He did not have the leg for it. It fell several yards short, and the Lions went to the West Final. Mike O'Shea is an excellent head coach and a smart person. That was a dumb decision. It was his first time head coach playoff decision, and it was dumb. It didn't work. And I've talked to people in Winnipeg's organization who were part of the team at the time who said, I still can't believe Mike did that. We were rolling on offense. You get one more first down, you make the kick shorter, and you kick it with zeros on the clock, not 30 seconds on the clock when BC can go the other way, get a field goal of their own. I was thinking about that play when I saw the Riders come out and try to convert this third down. Corey Mace, good head coach, smart person. And I'm on the record saying I think Corey Mace is going to be a Grey Cup champion at some point during his tenure in Saskatchewan. This decision was dumb. It was just dumb. If you get a first down, you're at your 30-yard line. Congratulations. If you don't get it, the game is over with 12 minutes left. Winnipeg could have gone 2-and-out, kicked a field goal, and gone up by 3 scores. And I think that the performance of the defense, who came out and immediately let Brady Oliveira rumble for 21 yards down the left sideline, was telling how deflated they felt. Like, really? We're gambling with 12 minutes left and we're not getting it? Yikes. And I also thought it was telling that the next time Saskatchewan was 3rd and 10 with 9 minutes and 51 seconds left on their own 39, and they punted. To me, that was telling. And I get Corey Mace said, I would probably do it again. Fair enough. I feel like in a few months from now, when he goes back and rewatches the film, he will have a different opinion. And I cite that next punt as the reason why. Because if you're gambling from your own 26, why are you not gambling from your own 39? Like, that to me didn't make any sense. So I hated the decision from Corey Mace. I give him credit and respect for doubling down, but I thought this was a first-time head coach mistake. The Calgary Stampeders were awarded the 113th Grey Cup in 2026, beating out their provincial rival Edmonton Elks with their bid. How do you feel about the game going back to Cowtown after it was most recently played there in 2019?
Well, this is a fascinating decision by the CFL because, as we all remember, after that game in 2019, Randy Ambrosi went on the record and said, look, this game is not coming back to Calgary until we get a shiny new stadium to replace McMahon. And here we are. It's going to be 7 years after that fact, and we're going to go back into the crumbling confines of McMahon Stadium to host the biggest showcase game in Canadian football. I think Calgary, like any CFL city, the fans there deserve the opportunity to have Grey Cups. I think that there is the potential here that there will be some nice renos to McMahon, some tweaks and changes that will make it better to accommodate this game. But
JC, you're being too nice. The CFL never should have gone back there until there was a new stadium. Use the leverage you have, okay? You're being way too nice. Just lay the hammer down.
It's true, okay? Like, you've gotten rid of all your leverage because now you've told the city and provincial governments that, hey, we don't really care if you invest in this new stadium. We're going to come back here regardless. And if you don't invest for another 6 years, we're going to come back here in 6 years anyway, because we're just going to keep coming back whenever we feel like it, because we're going to look at all the other things instead of the crumbling infrastructure that you continue to allow to be an eyesore in the center of your city. I was baffled by this decision.
Guys, look at Hamilton. How long did it go, Hodge? I'm looking at you because you're stat boy.
Well,
between Grey Cups and Hamilton.
Are we really comparing Hamilton to Calgary as cities, though? Really?
I'm not saying as cities, but I'm saying from a leverage standpoint. Like, if you're the CFL, and I know the point you're going to make here, Hodge, because you said it in the chat, and I want to leave it for you. But, like, why are you going back there? Honestly, go back to BC. I'm sure Amar Doman would be happy to do it a couple of years in a row, and you reward him for his commitment as an owner. You know, why not figure out somewhere else to go other than Calgary and keep your leverage? I just don't understand it.
I don't understand how you don't pick Edmonton's bid. Like, how bad was Edmonton's bid that you're not rewarding new ownership in? And look, Commonwealth isn't the most updated stadium out there.
But it's way better than
McMahon. It's larger and way better than McMahon. Like, I don't know how they must have completely messed up their arguments in terms of the festival and everything for you to pick Calgary over them. I simply do not understand that logic.
Yes. Now, I will say, Hamilton hosted, I believe it was 1998, and then not again until 2019. I believe so. That was, I think it was 21 years. I don't have that in front of me. That's off the top of my head. But I mean, let's not compare Hamilton as a market to Calgary. Calgary's got three times the population.
I'm not saying as a market. I'm just saying from the stadium perspective.
I will also stay in terms of Vancouver. The Lions hosted in 2021, played in that game, killed it. The CFL went back there in 2014, ended up giving a zillion tickets away because nobody was buying them. So I don't think that going back to Vancouver that quickly is a smart idea either. To me, the shocking thing is that this game's not in Edmonton. Now, should be noted, I talked to the city of Edmonton about 6 weeks ago. The reporting is up on our site. If you just Google, you know, Three Down Nation Hodge, Commonwealth Stadium, Edmonton renovations, whatever, it'll pop up.
96 was the last Grey Cup in Hamilton before the latest one.
But they hosted twice, right? They got 2019.
That's what I'm saying.
Or sorry, they got 2021. No festival.
And 2023.
And they got 2023. So they've hosted twice
after
in 3 years.
After they got a new stadium.
So Hamilton, but it's probably going to be another 20 years before Hamilton hosts again.
No, it won't. 20 years, bro.
10 at least, I would think. Well, maybe not 20. I suppose. And Hamilton did a good job hosting the Grey Cup. I should say in 2023, I was there. I was not there in 2021 when they hosted. And I got mixed up with 2019. 2019, they were in the game. It was in Calgary, of course. Regardless, there's a chance, it seems, like there's plans that have been drawn up to do a grand modernization of the amenities at Commonwealth Stadium that have not been redone. And it should be noted, they have done several over the last 10 years, very significant upgrades to Commonwealth. New seating, new sound system. They've done a lot of work on that building. Obviously, there's a lot left to be done. So maybe the thought is, if there's a plan to get this done by, let's say, 2029, maybe the Grey Cup goes there then. That being said, if the Elks were super confident that this was going to get done at some point, let's say over the next 5 years, then obviously they're not bidding on the 2026 Grey Cup. So I don't really know what to think about it from that perspective. I've not talked to Edmonton since this announcement came out. It should also be noted, when I talked to the city, they said, yeah, these renovations would cost $200 million, and we currently have $0 allocated for it. So it's like, okay, so this is kind of a pie in the sky idea, at least at this point. So maybe that's the future. The one thing I will say is, and a lot of people were happy to throw it in Randy's face that he made these comments back in 2019. And look, we've all clowned on Randy Ambrosi before, in many cases, rightfully so. I don't think that any public official or commission or person of leadership should be held accountable for a quote they gave in 2019 regarding major infrastructure in Canada. Because in 2019, there was no housing crisis. And also, the pandemic had never happened. And the worldwide inflation that has made everybody's lives more difficult as a result did not exist. So, yes, it is true that Randy Ambrosi made comments that were negative about Commonwealth Stadium or about McMahon Stadium in 2019. He said, we're never coming back to this building. We want to be in a new one, blah, blah, blah. I get all that. Personally, I don't think he should be clowned on for it because, like, look at Halifax. They had $20 million approved for a new stadium in 2019. And the second the pandemic hit and they were hit with a homelessness crisis, a housing crisis, like Dunk, you talked to the mayor of Halifax and basically he's like, look, my job right now is literally just housing and homelessness. Like, that is my job. The CFL couldn't be further on the back burner. We were hit with an emergency, tragic situation worldwide in 2020. So, now, obviously, Calgary should still be replacing McMahon Stadium. I'm not for a second suggesting that stadium doesn't stink. In fact, maybe there's a local park they could put up a temporary stadium for Grey Cup. I'd almost rather go there than McMahon. But I also get why we shouldn't necessarily be dunking repeatedly on the league. Like, the money that would have gone to a new stadium is simply not there yet. We're dealing with other stuff, which at the end of the day is more important than professional football.
I get that argument, Hodge, in terms of the infrastructure, but there are 8 other CFL cities. Like
that's what I'm saying.
It's not as if he's like forced.
Go to Edmonton.
Yeah.
Go to Ottawa.
There are other places can go.
Well, hold on, but a bunch of people online. Well, why not go to the East? Why not go to the, well, first of all, how about you bid for the damn Grey Cup if you want the Grey Cup? And let's go through the East. Hamilton just hosted. Toronto. They literally don't even have a team president to put the bid in. Ottawa is ripping down half of their building in the next like year and replacing it with entirely new stuff. And Montreal does not have a building. Percival Molson, way too small, and the Big O has been crumbling for 50 years with the plan to apparently spend $900 million on a new roof. So unless we're going to play this game in Randy's backyard in Burlington, where are we playing it? That is east of Winnipeg.
The Micmac Mall in Halifax.
Sure, we'll go to the Micmac Mall parking lot in Halifax.
That's what Mike Savage said. The
so like, I get that fans out east are upset about it, but I also don't think it's appropriate to be upset at the league office. Like, how dare you not put the Grey Cup in the East? Like, well, did any East team apply? Like, the CFL doesn't just arbitrarily pick between 9. They go through the bids. As far as we know from the reporting, there were 2 bids, and they came from the same province.
Okay, can we just, like, get over the bogus comments that are made about these bids? Well, like, the Calgary bid just absolutely blew us away. Like, what's the real difference here? Do we actually think
they're going to have a festival with beer? Holy smokes!
At the convention center, you know, like, can we just get over this?
They're going to have Canadian bands playing? Wow!
Like, until somebody absolutely reimagines Grey Cup, and I'm not dunking on anybody here, but, like, can we just stop talking about the bid process is decided much like this conversation. Okay. Hodge, I feel like you're Randy Ambrosi right now. And JC and I are a couple of members of the Board of Governors.
They're going to have parties. I love parties.
We're going, Randy, why do you want to take the game back to Calgary? You're crazy. And then Randy says all the things that you said. And we come back and say, okay, you might be right in some of that, but you know, won't Ottawa Stadium be ready by 2026? And how about giving it to the new guy in Edmonton? Like, come on, these bids, do they really? I like that they've sort of formalized the process, but, you know, what's the difference? Edmonton submitted a bid, and we don't have all the details, admittedly, that said exactly what you said. Okay, we're going to, at our convention center, have a bunch of Grey Cup team parties, and we have Canadian bands. Well, Calgary's going to do the same thing, their convention center, with a bunch, like, is there a better band there? Well, what's the pop star that's from Calgary. Is she going to play halftime of the Grey
McCray.
Cup?
Tate McRae.
Yes, if she plays halftime of the Grey Cup or anything around it, then I will be on board with the game being in Calgary. That is a legitimate reason to have an international Canadian star in and around your game.
Let's remember that Calgary is spending an ungodly amount of money on a new hockey arena attached to an event center, which I believe is where all of this stuff is set to take place. So I'd imagine that the province is going, hey, if we're spending zillions of dollars building this thing, we should probably try to get a marquee event here to show it off relatively far beyond that. Should also be noted that Alberta Minister of Tourism and Sport, Joseph Show, announced that the province is injecting $4 million into Calgary's Grey Cup, which I imagine talked to the CFL. I will say it's a little bit awkward when, as a province, you're like, yep, we're giving $4 million to this team's bid. And it's like, was that the case for Edmonton too? Because like
y'all are in
the same province. So I don't understand it. I wasn't in the room when this happened. I'm sure we're going to have the opportunity to talk to the CFL at length about this during Grey Cup, how this decision came about. Is it a weird decision? Yes. Am I excited to go to McMahon Stadium? Kind of, even just to say I was there. But regardless, it'll be a great Grey Cup. We'll have a grand old time.
When you
it'll
get there, you might not be saying that, Hodge.
Yeah, as long as we don't all die in the decrepit old elevator to go up to that press box. Boy, it's...
Yeah, Hodge, you know how long the media lineup's going to be to get up to the press box?
It's called
because I don't even think that you can walk up there.
Like a single pulley system on the outside. In like a 80-year-old elevator.
Bring your bungee cord. I'll spot you as you scale up because you'll probably get to the press box faster.
I almost exclusively take stairs at these types of events because I don't trust the elevators. And
that's what I'm saying. I don't even think you can walk up to the press box at McMahon Stadium.
You have to be able to. There's no way with fire codes. You can't get down.
It's that old.
You're saying it predates fire? You're saying it's old enough that it predates fire?
Hey, if a fire strikes in McMahon, you just jump off the side. Like, it's just, you sacrifice
yourself. If a fire starts at McMahon, that thing is going to go down in a hot minute, okay?
I don't know. Isn't it just made of concrete and asbestos? Like, neither of those things burn.
I will say this.
Come on.
Maybe we're being too harsh on McMahon, because you talked about the Big O crumbling, and McMahon has been crumbling for much longer than the Big O, and it's still standing. So maybe it's resilient? Is that...
This bid will be better if there is easy access for CFL fans and perhaps the media bus too, to go to Banff, maybe do a little skiing or snowboarding and sightseeing. That, to me, would elevate this, okay? Because Banff is absolutely stunning. I don't know if either of you have been there before or not.
I have. And I will say, it is recent precedent, right, for a city to be like, give us the Grey Cup, but also let's go to a much nicer city that's close by. Because that's what Hamilton did last year with Niagara Falls. So yeah, it wouldn't be the first time that's happened. The Final Four has been decided in U Sports as the Regina Rams host.
You guys aren't classy enough to have the CFL awards at the Banff Hotel, though. I'd have to dress you both for that.
Well, you're the one who's being rude by interrupting me. By the way, I will say...
Which fork do you use first at nice places like that? I never know.
You go from the outside in, bro. You're raised on a
farm. Always?
Yes! You go outside in, always. Your farm roots are showing.
He only needs one fork anyway, because he's just got a plague of quinoa and doesn't need anything else.
Except for when he picks up an entire cucumber with his hands and just eats it like a caveman.
Oh, yes.
Looking forward to that in Vancouver.
Grey Cup week is upon us, fellas.
That it is. The Final Four has been decided in U Sports as the Regina Rams will host the Laval Rouge Or in the Mitchell Bowl, and the Bishops Gators will host the Laurier Golden Hawks in the UTEC Bowl. Which conference final was the best game, and which bowl game are you most excited for?
I think there was a number of great conference finals. I think the best one, the most exciting one, and this is going to rankle some people, but it was the Loney Bowl. The back and forth between heavy underdog St. Mary's against a dominant Bishops team. The way that game finished with some of the absolutely crazy plays, a double-tipped ball that ends up being caught by a Huskies receiver that sets up a go-ahead touchdown. Then Bishops is marching down the field to tie the game, gets a fumble forced with seconds left. It looks like they're going to lose. And then St. Mary's runs the ball again. Another fumble forced. Bishops gets the ball back, ties the game up, goes to triple overtime. Like, that is an exciting finish in a conference title game. But as for next week, I think the clear choice for the more exciting of the two games is the Mitchell Bowl, because the Regina Rams and the Laval Rouge Or is going to be a fascinating matchup. Every year we hear people who follow U Sports talk about, well, you know, you could take the fourth best team in the Canada West and they would beat the best team in any other conference because the Canada West is so competitive. Well, here's a 3-5 regular season team from the Canada West who through the strength of their defense.
I don't know who says that.
People say it all the time online. That it's gone through the strength of their defense, been able to capture an unlikely Hardy Cup, and now they're going to go up against what has been one of the most successful programs in all of U Sports over the last two decades, and get a chance to prove that you can have a losing record in the Can West, and you can still compete with the big boys elsewhere in the country. I'm fascinated to see how that stacks up, because that Regina defense is legit.
Let's get serious here for a second. The best conference game was the Yates Cup. The Laurier Golden Hawks have an outstanding quarterback in Taylor Elgersma, who has now gone back-to-back years as OUA MVP for the first time since the early 2000s when Tommy Dennison did it for Queen's University. He balled out in the Yates Cup. Impressive performance, 18 of 30, 306 yards, 4 touchdowns in the game. Elgersma's great. I think he should legitimately be getting attention from NFL scouts down south. I'm not saying he's going to get a legitimate shot down there, but I think that he should at least garner that attention. And I think it could happen as this momentum builds. If Laurier especially can get to and win a Vanier Cup, that will capture more and more attention from scouts in the NFL and also around the CFL. The stat that stuck out most to me in this game was the fact that the Golden Hawks were able to outrush the vaunted Western Mustangs running attack, which has been led for years by Greg Marshall, their head coach, 298 yards to 210. Without losses accounted for, the Golden Hawks put up over 600 yards. With all due respect to the Mustangs, they put up some impressive numbers themselves. Evan Hillock, 323 yards, 2 touchdowns, no interceptions. If you told me a quarterback in a conference championship game was going to have a stat line like that, you'd probably say they would win. If you told me their starting running back in Keanu Yazbek was going to have 9 carries for 124 and 2 touchdowns, you'd probably say, yeah, they're going to win. And oh, by the way, the Mustangs averaged 8.1 yards per rush, but it was not even close to enough to beat this Laurier team, as the Golden Hawks put up a 50-burger, 51-31, the final. It was great scenes to see their packed house at the stadium with Laurier, but they cannot just be thinking that the Bishop's Gators are going to roll over. And I think the Mitchell Bowl is intriguing for all the reasons JC laid out. But we've seen in recent years that especially when teams have to travel east to play the AUS champ, that the AUS has been improving and that they are competitive. So Laurier, Taylor Elgersma, and Michael Foulds, I know Foulds will give the Gators the respect they deserve, but those players cannot get too high on their own supply and just think that this is a mere pit stop to a Vanier Cup appearance in Kingston. That is going to be a unique setting at Bishop's. I bet you it's going to be loud. It's going to be cool. You know, it makes me think of when Mount Allison, a number of years ago, hosted a national semifinal game against Laval. It ended up being a blowout, but the atmosphere was so unique because the school hadn't hosted it for so long. Same thing here with Bishop's. I don't even know when the last time was. Either of you stat boys know when Bishop's hosted a national semifinal?
I don't think it's happened this century.
No,
it's been a long time. So I think they've only that been to, four to me ever. Is why it's so intriguing. What was that, JC?
I think they've only been to four ever, just off the top of my head. Like they have not been a very successful program historically.
They are certainly an exemplary team, especially considering they're named after Sox. Pretty amazing stuff. To me, the best game.
You might want to explain that to some people, Hodge.
Well, a lot of people think that the Gators are named after like alligators, but it's G-A-I-T-E-R-S. They're named after what are essentially the fancy sock covers that were worn, I think, in the olden days by like soldiers. So anyway, I love college football names, and the Gators are among them. When you say Gators, people immediately think Florida, and it's like, no, I'm talking about French Canadian socks right now. That's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the Bishop's Gators. Regardless, the best game I thought was any time these two teams play. It's an incredible game, and that was Montreal at Laval. 18,000 people at Stade Telus in Quebec City as the home side won 22-17. These teams met twice in the regular season. The first one was a one-point win by Laval. The second was a one-point win by Montreal. It was unbelievably close. This game was also close. Olivier Cool, the man with probably the best name in maybe all of sports right now. Unbelievable performance, Laval, catching 10 passes for 144 yards and a touchdown from Arnaud Desjardins. I would love to be in Regina when the Laval Rouge or get off the plane there. let's recap. Regina, 3-5 regular season. They went on the road in the semi to Manitoba. They go on the road to Saskatoon for the Hardy Cup. Now they're at home, getting a home playoff game, and they're hosting Laval. Like, I don't want to be disrespectful, so I'm not going to do the French Canadian accent, but imagine the reaction from the Laval kids coming off the bus going, what in the tabernacle is this place? Like, this is Regina, Saskatchewan. I also would love to see
the Rams have a pretty featured player from Quebec. Did you know?
Well, and I was thinking about Adam O'Clair, who is obviously a sensational player for the Laval Rougeurs for many years, is now a starting weak side linebacker for the Saskatchewan Rough Riders. If I'm Adam O'Clair, I'm telling the Riders right now, don't book my plane ticket home until after this game that is taking place, because he's, I'm sure, going to be all decked out in his red and gold, rooting against the locals, who I'm sure will be not packing Mosaic Stadium. It's too big to pack for a U Sports game, but fans who will, I think, be turning out well for this one, especially if the weather holds out on the prairies, getting a home playoff game at Mosaic Stadium for U Sports. Very exciting. And for the full breakdown of both of these games, stay tuned to 3-Down Nation. That has become our annual tradition at Grey Cup. We tear it up, obviously, all week. But Saturday, we take it easy during the day. We watch these games. We read off them. Have a grand old time.
Fellas, can we just hold on, take a moment to think about this? The Regina Rams, just a few weeks ago, lost to the Saskatchewan Huskies at Griffith Stadium in Saskatoon during the regular season. And everybody, players included, and head coach Mark McConkey, thought their season was over because the Alberta Golden Bears had a big lead on the Manitoba Bisons. And if that held, the Rams' playoff chances were done. But the Bisons staged a ridiculous comeback, and McConkey watched the end of that with our contributor at 3-Down Nation, Brendan McGuire. And it was like they won. The bus ride back down to Regina was filled with a renewed energy. Then what do the Rams do? They go out and beat Alberta and then go on the path that Hodge talked about. Like, this team was oh so close to having their season over. It just makes the run even more unbelievable, unique, whatever words you want to call it, that their season, by all accounts and purposes, and from their own perspective, they thought was done. But the Bisons go and beat Alberta, and then the Rams travel to Manitoba and upset the number one seed. And here they are hosting a national semifinal. By the way, before we move on, the last time the Bishops sock team was in the national semifinal, 1994. I'd have to look it up and find out when they actually hosted, but they've only been there
a few other times before. Is it Blue or Blah? Hall of Fame defensive lineman.
Oh, Leroy Blue.
Leroy Blue, yeah.
He must have been on that team back then because he was a Bishops alum. Like, that must have been what he was
possible.
Playing.
It's probably been a rash.
Fourth ever national semifinal. 86, 88, 90, and 94. We'd have to go check Leroy Blue, but you're probably right.
I believe that is correct. I think that was also Arash Badani's freshman year at Bishops. University's never been the same since, unfortunately. We say that with love. We're friends with Arash.
That's the truth.
But should also be noted, as long as we're talking about history, this was the Regina Rams' first Hardy Cup since 2000.
Yeah.
And the second in their history. For context, the Saskatchewan Huskies have won 21.
Yeah. And they've
but the Rams
the
only
way,
went to
right?
the Canada West in what year?
The Rams went to, they were in the Canadian junior circuit. I don't know what year it was. So yeah,
the late 90s or maybe that year in 2000.
Their history is not as long, you are correct, but regardless, the point is they had played the last 23 years in Canada West and only reached 4 Hardy Cup games, not since 2012. So this was their first Hardy Cup appearance in over a decade, and they got the win.
The better comparison would be, how many Hardy Cups do the Huskies have since the Rams came into the Canada West?
Since 2000, I can tell you that the Huskies have, give me one second, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 Hardy Cups, including 3 since 2018. They went through a lull, none between 2007 and 2017. Since 2018, they've been to 5 of 6 Hardy Cups, winning 3. So big upset for the Rams. And full credit to Mark McConkey and his staff. Unbelievable performance.
Yeah, I do think it was the year 2000. The Rams bio says Frank McChrystal coached the Rams in their final 15 seasons at the junior level from 1984 to 1999. So their first year in the Canada West, they won a Hardy Cup and hadn't won one since.
Though I have a nitpick with that. 1984 to 1999 is not 15 seasons. That is 16 seasons. But I digress.
That's why you're stat boy.
That's why I'm stat boy. It's time for Hodges. No, stat boys. Heritage moment. On this day. By the way, I'll say
you
this.
You know what's going to happen all week, eh, Hodge?
I'll share this really quickly. So,
hey, stat boy.
On Friday, I went to Princess Auto Stadium for the pregame avails for the West Final. And TSN's Farhan Lalji sitting there. So I sit beside him. I shake his hand. I say, hey, Farhan, how's it going? And he looks at me and goes, Hodge. And I thought, oh, we've made it. The nickname has now made it outside of the podcast. So anyway, shout out to Farhan.
Sorry. The Rams participated in CIS football starting in 1999.
Okay.
So their second season in U Sports.
I also... speaking of Farhan, during the East Final, again, a bunch of the media folks were watching the game together. He left to take a phone call. Chad Kelly breaks his ankle about 2 minutes later. 2 minutes after that, Farhan comes back in. He says, what I miss? I said, Chad Kelly just broke his ankle. And he looks at me, he goes, no, seriously, what I miss? And I'm like, I'm not joking. And then Farhan kind of does a look around the room and everyone's kind of looking at him like, yeah, he's not joking. And it was funny to break the news to Farhan Lalji. Farhan Lalji, often the one breaking the news. I got to break the news to him. It made me feel good. On this day in 2019, Nathan Shepard recorded his first career NFL sack in a 34-27 victory over the New York Giants. The former third-round pick out of Ajax, Ontario, would dress for 9 games on the year, recording 6 tackles and 2 sacks with the New York Jets. Now with the New Orleans Saints, Shepard recently made headlines for trying to illegally twist the leg of Los Angeles Chargers quarterback Justin Herbert, which cost him a fine of $11,817, which I thought was a weirdly particular amount. Like, why not $11,816 or $11,818? But whatever, I'm not in charge of NFL fines. JC, I know you saw this play. What'd you think when you saw Nathan Shepard trying to rip Justin Herbert's leg off?
Well, it was an egregious, dirty play by Shepard, but I didn't recognize it initially that it was Shepard. I heard that something had happened to Herbert. I saw the video cross my screen. I looked at it and I went, oh, that's disgusting. Scrolled by and then I did a double take. I had to go back. I'm like, that's Nathan Shepard, formerly of Simon Fraser University and then later on Fort Hays State, the Canadian defensive lineman. So I was surprised. He doesn't necessarily have a reputation for being dirty before this hit, but that was certainly a big mental error from him in a play I hope he doesn't repeat.
Let's go to the three-minute drill, fellas. Maya Turner was named a Canada West All-Star after going 14 for 18 on her field goals for the University of Manitoba Bisons. Well-deserved, eh?
Absolutely. Her long was almost 50 yards. She 100% deserved it. And I just want to say a big go suck it to all of the haters and losers who, when Maya Turner first made the Manitoba Bisons roster, said, this is garbage, this is a stunt, this is whatever. Guess what? She's better than all the other kickers in the Can West, and she proved it. Go suck an egg. The CFL levied max fines against BC linebacker.
What if it breaks and spills all over?
Good. Against BC linebacker Ace Ely and Ottawa linebacker Frankie Griffin following last week's semifinal action. Were those deserved?
They were absolutely deserved. Both of these were egregious hits to the head. My question is, though, why was there no fine for Nelson Lacumbo, who hit Keon Hatcher in the head just a few plays later in that BC game? I also thought that should have deserved a fine, even if it may not have been as egregious as the other two hits. Canadian running back Chuba Hubbard signed a 4-year, $33 million extension with the Carolina Panthers this week. What does that mean for his future?
It means Chuba making that generational money. My goodness, dude getting paid. And it shows that the Carolina Panthers are committed to this dude in the backfield, at least for the foreseeable future. We know things can change fast, but Chuba Hubbard has been balling out, Canadian or not, in the NFL. People should be tuning in to watch him, even though the Panthers aren't really that good of a football team this year. Veteran defensive back Luchez Purifoy won an epic... Let me start that again. Veteran safety Luchez Purifoy won on an epic social media rant after he did not get picked for this year's All-CFL first team. Was he justified in feeling so, so angry?
I think to an extent. I think he was better than Marc-Antoine Dacroix this year. But my vote for the East All-Star safety was the guy who I thought was the best safety in the CFL this year, which was Stavros Katsantonis. So I think Purifoy was right in feeling a little bit ripped off against Dacroix, but I don't think he should have been up against Dacroix anyway. The St. Clair Saints beat the Okanagan Sun 37-22 to become the first Ontario team to win the Canadian Bowl since 1999. How cool is that?
It's awesome that they've corrected one of the biggest disparities in Canadian sports, and they did it the hard way. They were down 13 points in the third quarter, scored three rushing touchdowns from quarterback Maurice Soja in 7 minutes to jump in front, and then coasted from there. Taylor Elgersma has been named the OUA's most outstanding player for the second straight year. Will he win the Heck Crichton 2, Dunk?
Yes, say it with me. Elgersma. Elgersma. Elgersma.
Elgersma. What did I say?
Not Elgersma. 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 When you say Elgersma, it makes me think that he's slow. And this dude ain't slow for a passer, okay? He's got an ultra-quick release. This dude this year, 74.5% completion percentage, over 2,600 yards. That's over 330 per game. For those that don't know, they only play 8 regular season games in Canadian university football. And Brendan McGuire, it's not Canadian college football, okay? It's university up here. 20 touchdown passes. He will win the Heck Crichton Trophy. That is Taylor Elgersma, not Elgersma.
Okay,
got
if
it
you're
good
gonna,
since
if,
you understood.
Hold on, hold on. If you're going to roast JC about how to say Taylor Elgersma, I expect you to say this next name right, because I have coached you on it before. So let's hear it. Go for it, Mr. Doug. Let's hear it.
Which name? Zach Kolaris.
No, it's Kolaris. It always has been. It always will be. Zach Kolaris. Nobody says
no, you
it
know
right.
What it should be? Like, I need to have a conversation with Zach at Grey Cup. Can it just be Kolaris? Can it just be Kolaris?
You want somebody else to change their name to fit your convenient lifestyle?
Not really mine. It's just everybody says Kolaris.
So because everybody's wrong, that should be it?
No, but I suppose you have a point. Say it again.
Kolaris.
Kolaris?
Kolaris.
Not Kolaris.
That was right. Kolaris.
I thought I said it wrong.
Say it.
I said it wrong, and I thought I said it right.
This is making
when I said
for,
it right, I said it wrong.
This is making for a riveting podcast, by the way. Kolaris.
Anyways, that guy who wears number 8 and plays quarterback for the Winnipeg Blue Bombers sent his University of Cincinnati roommates, Travis and Jason Kelsey, a package filled with Winnipeg Blue Bombers gear to wear on their podcast. Jason lost his, apparently, amongst all the beer in his garage. Does that sound like Jason?
It apparently does. From the clips that I've seen of their show, this does seem to fit Jason Kelsey's personality. Also, to tie us back to what we started with today, I'll never forget after Jason Kelsey made his debut on ESPN, I believe it was last year, the next day was last year's West Final Media Day. And Ted Wyman, rest in peace, came up to me and said, you know what? All last night I was thinking, Jason Kelsey reminds me of somebody. Who the heck does he remind me of? And he's like, and I just realized it's you. And he's not the first person to suggest I look like Jason Kelsey. Now,
yes,
now that
bro, he's right.
Now that I've got the shaved head, it's less of a comparison. But when I had the full head of hair, yeah, the resemblance was there. Oh, I will fully admit
it. You know what you have to do then?
People's sexiest man alive, one of them.
Grow your hair back. I think they're talking about Travis Kelsey because he's with Taylor Swift, but fair point, JC. But Hodge, grow your hair back, man.
No.
Come on, bro.
I will say.
You and Jason Kelsey, twinsies, twinning, doppelganger, let's do it.
I will say at last year's Grey Cup, Ted was talking to Zach Kolaris during the 30-minute availability we get on Wednesday. And I said to Zach, just straight up, I'm like, by the way, Ted thinks I'm a dead ringer for Jason Kelce. Do you see it? And he looked at me and he went, not really. And I said, really? And he said, no, you're not balding. And I was like, well, clearly you haven't seen the top of my head, then. I don't know what you're going on about.
Did you turn around and point to your bald spot?
No, because that would have been embarrassing.
Or bend down?
But I am tall, so most people didn't see the bald spot. Regardless.
Instead of Movember, we need to start a campaign for Hodge to grow his hair back.
Movember, moral, I don't know how you come up with something like that. No, it's not happening. Vernon Adams Jr. said he was, quote, totally crushed, close quote, by the BC Lions' decision to keep Nathan Rourke as the team's starting quarterback after he returned from injury. What will the team do at the quarterback position going forward?
It is absolutely clear that it will be Nathan Rourke as this team's quarterback and that Vernon Adams Jr. will be traded. VA said he didn't know what the future holds. Nathan Rourke immediately afterwards said, I know for certain I will be here next year. It's clear he's been given assurances that VA wasn't. Canadian QB Curtis Rourke threw two touchdowns as Indiana defeated the defending national champion Michigan Wolverines on Saturday. Do the 10-0 Hoosiers actually have a shot against number 2 ranked Ohio State Buckeyes next week?
Yes. Don't you know what Kurt Cignetti says, the head coach at Indiana? I win. Just Google me. That's all this team has done since he's gotten there. And yes, they do have a chance because the Buckeyes have started some games slow at home. And this Hoosiers team, for as good as Curtis Rourke has been, is a legitimate team. I think they can give the Buckeyes a game and, dare I say, have the opportunity to go in there and pull the upset. Like, we're not talking about the Hoosiers who are unranked going in here. We're talking about a team that is ranked inside the top 10 playing against Ohio State. And I think the real question here is, I don't even want to say if, but when Curtis Rourke goes in there and plays well, how much does that elevate, JC, I'm looking at you, draft nerd, his NFL draft stock?
I think it will absolutely elevate him. If he can play well against Ohio State, and it's seeming likely at this point, Indiana makes the 12-team college football playoff. If he can play well in those primetime games, right now he's a guy who's getting buzz as a second, third-round quarterback just outside of that sort of upper echelon of guys. Well, all those guys are struggling right now, except maybe the top two and Cam Ward and Shedeur Sanders. I think he can get into that top 5 quarterback conversation with a couple of strong primetime performances.
Okay, like, let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. All right, you go back to October 26th. Nebraska went in there after the Hoosiers just absolutely beat the piss out of the Cornhuskers in Indiana, and the Cornhuskers lost by 4 to Ohio State on Ohio State's home field. Okay? You look at some of these games that they've had this season, and that is the one that stands out most to me. It's a different day and all the rest, but the Hoosiers definitely have a legitimate shot to go in there and pull an upset with Curtis Rourke, a Canadian, at the controls. This is rarefied stuff, fellas. There has never been a Canadian, I believe. We would need to check Jesse Palmer, stat boy. I don't know if you can get on this quick enough. That has played for a team that is ranked this high in the NCAA. Jesse Palmer played for the University of Florida. I know most people know him from The Bachelor, and he played on some pretty good teams there. So there's a chance that he's the only other one, but he would be the only other guy that's ever been in a position like this. Like, this game is, JC, forgive me if I'm wrong, you tell me, the game of the week in NCAA football, bar none.
I would argue it is, but I don't have the full schedule in front of me.
One could argue it's one of the biggest games ever played by a Canadian quarterback. Like Mark Rippon started Super Bowls, so that's obviously number one. There have been, you know, Russ Jackson in the Grey Cup, obviously, like those.
It might be the biggest NCAA game ever played by a Canadian quarterback.
It very well might be. On that note, thank you for listening to the longest 3-minute drill of all time. And a quick housekeeping note, this podcast is obviously coming out Sunday. We decided to record early. Monday is our travel day. We will be doing a midweek podcast. Anybody who's been to Grey Cup knows that the days just kind of run together. So I don't want to super commit to like a firm time, but we're shooting for Friday morning. That way we could still tee up the game, but we can also talk about the awards that'll be handed out the night before on Thursday in Vancouver. Three Down is going to have five reporters on the ground in Vancouver in today's media landscape. That is unbelievable.
Coming strong, baby.
So we super appreciate the support we're getting from all of our readers, listeners, viewers. Stick with us, 3downnation.com. We're going to have all the news and more. Enjoy it. Great Cup. Best week of the year. We'll see you then.
New Balance recently announced the addition of All-American Cooper Flagg to the NB family, joining Cameron Brink and an elite player roster in the brand's mission of growing the game with the next generation of athletes. In part of New Balance's ongoing commitment to supporting athletes off the court, the Boston-based brand plans to work with Cooper on community initiatives in his home state of Maine. To shop the two-way V5, Hesse Low V2, and all New Balance basketball products, visit newbalance.com today.
This is the story of the one who, as a maintenance specialist for a historic high-rise, knows that vintage charm historically needs constant attention. Which is why, when it's time to upgrade turn-of-the-century mechanicals, they turn to Grainger. With easy access to a million-plus products and the scale to deliver when and where you need them, the right tools and supplies are never far away. So the one can keep that vintage building running like new. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.